When I came out, one of my first surprises about the queer community was that everyone in it didn't always get along. In fact, sometimes it seemed like gay men and lesbians get along better with everyone else than they do with one another.
In general, where one religion is imposed on a whole society, it also means that one traditional set of sexual norms is likely to be imposed on a whole society.
Welcome to This Way Out, the International Lesbian and Gay Radio Magazine. I'm Lucia Chappelle. Another Mugabe ally ousted in gay sex scandal, Third World Queers coalesce for success, and the separate evolutions of the gay and lesbian liberation movements. All that and more this week, now that you've discovered This Way Out.
I'm Dean Elzinger.
And I'm Lucia Chappelle.
With NewsWrap, a summary of some of the news in or affecting the gay and lesbian community for the week ending April 6, 2002. Another prominent Zimbabwe official and ardent ally of infamously homophobic President Robert Mugabe has been toppled as the result of a gay sex scandal. Alim Mpofu, chief executive of the state-run Zimbabwe Broadcasting Corporation, resigned before an investigation into his arrest at a Harare nightclub last week. Mpofu, a leader in Mugabe's vitriolic pre-election propaganda campaign against gays, whites, and anyone else in the opposition, was discovered in a compromising position with a young man in a corridor of the Tipperary Club, handcuffed to a fire hydrant outside as club patrons gathered to hurl insults at him. Mpofu appealed to the son of the club's owner, Pearson Mbalekwa, himself an MP in Mugabe's ZANU-PF party, for aid. Mpofu was released at Mbalekwa's request, but it was too late. Information Minister Jonathan Moyo, who chose his friend Mpofu to head Zimbabwe Broadcasting and to toe the Mugabe party line, called Mpofu's behavior totally unacceptable and went on to say that sexual perverts need to be told once again that homosexuality is unnatural. The only people who accept homosexuality are liberals who think it is a way of getting votes.
The fall of Mpofu, just 2 years after the conviction of former President Kanan Banana on sodomy charges, has the group Gays and Lesbians of Zimbabwe, or GALS, asking how many homosexuals do work for Mugabe, who, among other things, has called gays worse than pigs and dogs. A statement from GALS says that Mpofu, whom they had known for years was gay, should have resigned rather than participate in Mugabe's strongly criticized election campaign. Calling for both legal and cultural reform, the statement said, Mr. Mpofu's situation again lends credence to GAL's claims that, far from being absent from African cultures, homosexuality is deeply embedded in all strata of societies on this continent.
The laws banning gay sex are used all over the world for a variety of purposes. But prosecutors in Jefferson County, Missouri, have come up with a new twist. They say that the charges now being brought against six men are part of an attempt to break a pornography ring. However, of the 13 people arrested in a raid on a High Ridge adult video store, only the six who allegedly violated the state's law against deviant sexual intercourse with another person of the same sex were ultimately charged. Jefferson County Prosecutor Bob Wilkins said he did have some hesitation about applying the rarely used statute, but that this is not about throwing homosexuals in jail. This is about trying to prevent future conduct. Although Missouri's Western District Court of Appeals ruled in 1999 that the sex law was unconstitutional because it bans consensual activities, Wilkins said that it remains on the books because the state failed to take that decision to the state Supreme Court for affirmation. Local activists hope that this will be the last time the law can be used at all. They foresee the departure of dozens of term-limited legislators as a chance to finally get the law repealed this session.
In the Australian state of Victoria, a first-of-its-kind Melbourne family court ruling has increased passions around the debate over the right of lesbians to have access to reproductive clinics. The case involved a gay sperm donor's quest for increased visitation with the child he fathered for a lesbian couple. After the trio's initial amicable agreement, the mother and her partner became concerned when the donor asked to be present at the birth. They concealed the birthing arrangements from him, but he was able to locate them and the child through a private investigator. The women then agreed to limited visits, but the donor, who had been involved in child-rearing previously with great satisfaction, wanted more. Family Court Justice Paul Guest affirmed that the child's mothers were providing him with a loving home, but said that he could also benefit from contact with the donor. Guest approved overnight stays and alternate weekend and school holiday visits. Lesbian rights activists say the case clearly demonstrates the need for Victoria's legal sperm banks to be open to so-called socially infertile women. Viv Ray of the Lesbian Parent Group said, "No matter what is decided before the birth or what contracts are entered into, once a baby is born, people's feelings change. We need legislation to secure the rights of lesbians to have families. Their right to have babies can't be based on trust. There must be a legal basis."
In the U.S., an ABC News poll indicates that since the network featured Rosie O'Donnell in a primetime interview on the subject, a bare majority of Americans now support allowing lesbian and gay couples to adopt children. But that doesn't mean gay and lesbian parents are having an easier time in the courts. Oral arguments were heard this week in the Nebraska Supreme Court in the case of Serena Russell and Joan Bridgens. Bridgens adopted a child in Pennsylvania in 1996 with Russell as named co-parent. Russell and Bridgens broke up after several years, and Russell went to court to ask for sole custody. However, a Nebraska district judge found the adoption to be invalid in the first place because Bridgens had not relinquished her parental rights before the adoption. Russell's attorney argues that the judge had no authority to void an adoption that had years ago been declared final in another state. Meanwhile, back in Pennsylvania, one gay and one lesbian couple will be going to that state's high court to challenge the ban on joint adoptions. 75 organizations, including child welfare agencies, have signed on to the appeal as friends of the court.
In Maryland and in California, there's tax relief in store for gay and lesbian couples. On April 2nd, the Montgomery County Council in Maryland unanimously passed a plan to provide same-gender partners with the same exemption from real estate taxes that heterosexual married couples receive when one transfers property into the other's name. To qualify, gay or lesbian couples must prove that they share a close personal relationship, are responsible for each other's welfare, have shared the same legal residence for at least 1 year, and that their finances are intertwined. On the same day, the City Council of San Jose, California, unanimously voted to draft a similar ordinance. Real estate transfer tax exemptions for same-gender domestic partners already exist in San Francisco, Oakland, Sacramento, and Berkeley, California, and in Philadelphia, Pennsylvania.
The Quebec Human Rights Commission has ruled in favor of a gay Montreal couple and ordered the neighbors who harassed them to pay $36,000 Canadian. Roger Thibault and Teal Wouters complained that Robert Walker, who lives next door, and Greg Inglis, who also lives nearby, harassed them continually, including running over their flower beds, attempting to hit them with their cars, and whacking golf balls at them as they lounged in their backyard. The case was boosted last year when about 4,000 people marched in support of Thibault and Wouters' demand to be left in peace. Although the commission does not have the power to enforce the payment, if Walker and Inglis do not comply by April 19th, the commission's lawyers will take the case to the Quebec Human Rights Tribunal.
Vietnam saw its first Pride celebration last week, and the reaction from the conservative government and the press was rather predictable. Several hundred attended a fashion parade and dance at a Long Hai hotel in the southern part of the country. Almost immediately, the state-run media produced a report from the Ministry of Labor, War, Invalids, and Social Affairs indicating that gay couples are on the rise and that the activities of this social evil are just now coming to light. The official youth-oriented daily newspaper Thanh Nhien called the Pride event a monstrosity. Although the Vietnamese government did not prevent the event from going on, there are now calls for a crackdown on such activities.
And finally, denials are once again in order as gay icon Liza Minnelli and her brand new husband, David Guest, fend off rumors that he may not be altogether heterosexual. No less than Sir Elton John had been cited as one source for the information. After reporters asked him what a good wedding gift would be for his old friend, he replied, "A heterosexual husband." Minnelli vouches 100% for Guest's prowess with women, although her track record is less than promising. She was first married to gay singer-songwriter Peter Allen. Her father, director Vincent Minnelli, was bi, and her mother, Judy Garland, was once married to gay Mark Herron. And then she herself confessed to the Texas Triangle newspaper that her gaydar is not that good. "I'm terrible," she said. "You're talking to the girl who married Peter Allen."
That's News Wrap for the week ending April 6th, 2002. Follow the news in your area. An informed community is a strong community.
News Wrap was written this week by Lucia Chappell and recorded at the studios of KPFK Los Angeles. For This Way Out, I'm Dean Elzinga.
And I'm Lucia Chappell. How can you tell the difference between a lesbian and a gay man? We'll have the answer to that riddle from a historical perspective later in the program. The queer world is a different world in the third world, according to Peter Drucker.
In Europe and North America and in Australia, the movement has tended to confirm a certain kind of distinct lesbian gay identity, a certain kind of distinct lesbian gay community, and this pattern is not likely to catch on in the same way in much of the third world, I think.
That was the main theme covered in the first part of our discussion with Peter Drucker, the editor of Different Rainbows, an anthology of essays by third world lesbian, gay, bi, and trans activists. Drucker, who is originally from the U.S. and now based in the Netherlands, is a longtime socialist and gay activist. As we continue with part two of his conversation with This Way Out's Australia-based Michael Schembri, Drucker takes a closer look at the unique patterns being created by third world queer liberation movements.
You point out in your introduction, as well as several of the authors do, that the best successes for the gay, lesbian, transgender movement in the third world has been in those areas where they were part of a movement, a wider movement for social liberation.
It makes sense that when a society is in ferment and people are fighting for more freedom on different levels, that they're also ready to reconsider their opinions about lots of things, including about sexuality. South Africa is a wonderful example. In South Africa, the lesbian gay movement was really essentially born out of the anti-apartheid movement. Simon Nkoli is the most famous example of a prominent gay activist who was also a prominent activist in the African National Congress, but he's not the only example. There were lots of linkages, and that led to the situation that South Africa became the first country in the world to put into its constitution a ban on discrimination on the basis of sexual orientation. So that's one good example of how social change and democratic openings can be linked to lesbian gay liberation. Sandinista Nicaragua, in the end, before the Sandinistas fell, turned out to be another good example. And in Asia today, we see the first beginnings of a similar process of linkage. Since the start of the Asian economic crisis in 1997, you see the rise of the left in different countries, for example, in Indonesia, building the movement that led to the fall of the Suharto dictatorship. And the fledgling lesbian gay movement in Indonesia has linked up with that left to some extent. So I think that's a very promising development for the lesbian gay movement in Asia for the future.
You stress the importance of a minimal democratic space for a gay lesbian movement to make an appearance and function inside the country. How do you relate that, say, to the Islamic world, where I think Turkey and Indonesia are only the exception?
Yeah. The Islamic world, particularly the Middle East, is certainly the part of the third world where lesbian gay movements have the most difficulty. And I think it's interesting to see that that's not just a question of the role of Islam as a religion. It's true that Islam as a religion is not particularly pro-gay any more than Christianity or Judaism were particularly pro-gay. But there's also a link to the colonial history of the Middle East and of many parts of the Islamic world. It's interesting that Turkey, as you mentioned, is the one Middle Eastern country where the lesbian gay movement at this point is the strongest, and it's also one of the very few Middle Eastern countries that was never colonized by Britain or France. And that's not an accident, I think. In the process of resisting colonization, Turkey established a secular state and a certain number of secular norms for society that gave room for different kinds of communities and different kind of movements to grow up. Whereas countries like Egypt or Pakistan, which were ruled from Britain, were countries where the colonial empire relied on traditional forms of authority and the traditional authority of Islam to ensure social stability and the stability of its empire. So those are countries where there's virtually no room for lesbian gay movements today. It certainly got nothing to do with any presence of non-Muslims. You know, Egypt is a country that has, proportionately and in absolute numbers, many more Christians than Turkey does, but that certainly hasn't increased the level of tolerance for homosexuality in Egypt.
So would you argue that secularization is very important all over the third world countries?
Yes, absolutely. Perhaps more important in some countries than others, depending on the religion you're dealing with. In a country like Thailand, where the traditional religion is Buddhism, is perhaps not quite as important because Buddhism traditionally is nowhere near as anti-gay or suspicious of sexuality in general than the traditional monotheistic religions, or Hinduism for that matter. But still, in general, where one religion is imposed on a whole society, it also means that one traditional set of sexual norms is likely to be imposed on a whole society. And part of the process of opening up space for more sexual diversity is challenging the predominance of that single set of norms in that single religion. So I think that's a basic question of the fight for democracy, the fight to separate religion from society and religion from politics.
The editor of the Gay Men's Press anthology, Different Rainbows, talks about the impact of the war on terrorism and other social and political forces on third world gay, lesbian, bi, and trans movements. Tune in for the conclusion of Michael Schembri's interview with Peter Drucker next time on This Way Out.
This is Psycho Simon Ngodi speaking from Johannesburg on This Way Out International Lesbian and Gay Radio Magazine.
Lesbian lecturer Jane Ward takes aim at some common stereotypes with a sense of history and a sense of humor.
I love lesbian U-Haul jokes, but my favorite is the one that contrasts lesbian dating habits with those of gay men. It goes like this. What do lesbians bring on the second date? A U-Haul. What do gay men bring on the second date? What second date? This joke is based on stereotypes, and of course there are always exceptions to stereotypes, but the joke also seems to reflect one of our community's perceptions about real differences between gay men and lesbians. When I came out, one of my first surprises about the queer community was that everyone in it didn't always get along. In fact, sometimes it seemed like gay men and lesbians get along better with everyone else than they do with one another. While this may be confusing for some of my straight friends, my queer friends and I have come to take for granted that lesbians and gay men sometimes have little in common. Is this simply because our tastes and lifestyles are different, as reflected in the joke about our second dates? And if so, why? Are these differences biological? Sociologists believe that patterns and gender differences aren't about biology, but are about our gender socialization and our responses to social and historical developments in the era in which we live. In other words, we learn the behaviors that are believed to be appropriate to our gender, and we learn these behaviors in the context of the political and economic moment we live in. With this in mind, I decided to turn to gay and lesbian history to make sense of the joke about the second date. I decided to see if there wasn't something about the way our community has developed, or been forced to develop, that has contributed to the sometimes divergent political interests and social priorities of gay men and lesbians. Well, I found just that. It turns out that the social separation of gay men and lesbians has a long history, dating as far back as feudal Europe. During the 16th and 17th centuries, having a large family based around reproduction was important because the hard labor of each family member was essential to the livelihood of the family. As a result, marriages were primarily practical arrangements, which meant that one's personal preference of a marriage partner could figure in only as one factor in the selection of a mate. The notion of romantic love, or having your spouse be the source of love and affection, was considered a dangerous kind of distraction from the labor of the family. If you were lucky, you may develop an emotional attachment to your husband or wife during the course of your marriage, but it was also common for people to find their intimate love relationships outside of marriage. During the feudal period, same-sex sexuality was most likely to occur in the context of friendships or working relationships. Yet the consequences of these relationships were different for gay men than for lesbians. For men, these relationships were likely to take place in public institutions that only men were allowed to attend, like seminary, college, or the army, and many also took place between wealthy men and their servants. While this may sound exciting, historians point out that the only reason we know about these relationships is because of the stigma and criminality attached to them. In 16th century England, sodomy laws strictly prohibited sex between men, and many men who were caught in violation of these laws were put on trial and even executed. But the story is different for women. While women were also having intense sexual relationships with their best friends, there was no stigma attached to these relationships as long as the women involved were married, feminine, and were not trying to pass as men. Now, this should not be taken as any indication of acceptance of lesbianism, however, because it's more accurate to say that these relationships went unnoticed. Lesbian historian Lillian Faderman explains why when she states, quote, "Because love without a penis was an impossibility to 16th century England, women were allowed to demonstrate the most sensual behavior toward one another without suffering stigma." And this notion that women cannot be sexual without help from men continued on for hundreds of years after this. And while this is a terribly sexist notion, on the other hand, it certainly allowed for a lot of exciting lesbian sex during this period. Later, the main factor that distinguished the modern period of the 18th and 19th centuries from the feudal period was the development of male social networks founded on interest in same-sex sexuality. Prior to this, homosexuality emerged in already established relationships like best friends or colleagues. But in the modern period, people who may have had no previous contact with each other discovered one another through mutual attraction. The best evidence of this comes from the Molly Houses of the early 1700s. Molly Houses were meeting places for gay men from all walks of life, and there is written record of their existence in at least London, Paris, and Amsterdam. Men in the 18th century had created social scenes in which they could meet new partners and develop a community based on same-sex interest. Yet again, they did so at risk of being discovered, arrested, and even executed by local authorities. Women interested in same-sex sexuality, on the other hand, were relatively safe from cruel sanctions as they continued to be relegated to the private sphere of home and family. While this provided early lesbians with relative physical safety, it also kept women severely isolated and limited their opportunities to meet other women or develop social networks. By the 1800s, the notion of romantic love was in full swing, and people living in the U.S., specifically white men, had increasingly more power to decide whom they were going to marry. For men, most of whom were now working for wages in the paid labor force, economic security had less to do with family life than it did for women. Men began to have even greater access to the leisure of the public sphere, and this meant that they could find each other in pubs, cafes, parks, train stations, and all of the new public venues that came with the Industrial Revolution. Women remained far less mobile than men, which meant that female bonding and romantic friendships continued as they had in the feudal mode. Yet for middle and upper class women, one new site for the development of romantic relationships between women emerged: all women's colleges. In the late 1800s, one of my personal favorite moments in lesbian history, women with the economic means to do so started entering colleges, and it was not uncommon for them to develop wild crushes on one another that were called smashes. But despite these smashes, a lesbian life independent of a husband and family was impossible for most of these women. And it wasn't until the very end of the 19th century that some romantic friends became lesbians in the sense that we think of today. Lesbian partnership became more and more of an option as women entered the paid labor force and acquired financial independence from men, which allowed them to more freely choose their companions. forward to the 1970s, the era of gay liberation. While gay men were fighting for their right to have public sex venues and to not be arrested on homophobic charges of lewd conduct, many lesbians were fighting to shut down the pornography industry and were joining a feminist movement that instead emphasized freedom from men and the rigid constraints of the traditional family. At the time, these different priorities were at the crux of serious conflict between many gay men and lesbians, and prior to the AIDS crisis, these very differences were part of a widening political and social gap between the two communities. Looking back in history helps us to understand why gay men and lesbians might define liberation differently, and why these political values might also influence our different social choices. For gay men, who had for centuries been arrested and executed as punishment for their sexual desire, it makes sense that gay liberation might be defined as sexual liberation, freedom to be sexual without risk of arrest or execution. And for lesbians, who had for centuries been prevented from establishing lesbian communities because they were confined to the private sphere of heterosexual marriage and childbearing, it makes sense that liberation would be defined as a feminist struggle, a struggle to develop communities with other women, and sometimes apart from men. It is no wonder, then, that gay men and lesbians sometimes express our identities differently, because for centuries we've had to. Sexism and homophobia have been used against us differently, and therefore our defense mechanisms have had to be different. So, gay men, next time you're sitting around with your friends complaining that lesbians are boring, or lesbians, next time you're sitting around with your friends complaining that gay men are shallow, you might consider that these stereotypes are in part a reflection of our different reactions to a different historical form of oppression. And then, you might just consider calling up your favorite lesbian or gay man, renting a U-Haul and some gay porn, and getting to know each other a little bit better.
Jane Ward has taught lesbian, gay, bisexual, transgender history at the University of California, Santa Barbara. Thanks for choosing This Way Out, the International Lesbian and Gay Radio Magazine. This week, Dean Elzinga, Graham Underhill, Brian Nunes, Jason Lynn, Chris Ambage, Rex Walkner, Michael Schembri, and Jane Ward contributed program material. Thanks also to Chris Allen. Kim Wilson composed and performed our theme music. Remember, you can listen to This Way Out anytime online, exclusively on Planet Out. Just point your browser to www.planetout.com and click first on multimedia, then on radio. Some This Way Out operating expenses are funded by a grant from the Kicking Assets Fund of the Tides Foundation and through direct charitable donations from our listeners around the world. To learn how you can help This Way Out stay on the air, please visit our website at thiswayout.org, email us at tworadio@aol.com, or write to us at Post Office Box 38327, Los Angeles, California, 90038, USA. For coordinating producer Greg Gordon and the entire This Way Out family, I'm Lucia Chappell. Thanks for listening on CJSF Burnaby, British Columbia, WERU Blue Hill Falls, Maine, KKFI Kansas City, Missouri, and more than 125 other stations around the world, including this community radio station. Now, y'all, stay tuned.